Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. We talk a lot about impact investing on this show. One way to make a difference is through something called community bonds. Tim Nash is a sustainable economist and founder of Good Investing, and he's here to talk about how community bonds work and what's available for investors here in Canada. And the reality is so many people have debt these days, like a lot of debt. What happens when you can't pay it off? There are options out there. And we're going to talk about two within the world of insolvency. Adam Fisher is with the insolvency firm Harrison Partners. He's going to talk about different options, including consumer proposals and bankruptcy filings. Then we all know it is so important to pay your taxes, but sometimes you might just not agree with the amount that you have been told to pay. Something looks wrong to you and you want to take it up with the CRA. Amit Umat is a tax lawyer in the province of Ontario. He's going to talk about how you go about filing a dispute with the CRA and what some of the most common issues he sees and is dealing with his clients. Plus, if you're self-employed and you own your own business, then money, unfortunately, will not magically appear when you retire. You're probably not going to get a pension. How do you start planning and saving for retirement? Process is quite different for entrepreneurs. Personal finance columnist Leslie Ann Scorgi is here to talk about some tips on how to get started. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. Bond. Not James. I know you thought I was going to say James Bond. I'm not saying James Bond. I'm saying rather community. Community. Bond. On this show, we have talked for years about sustainable investing and impact investing and all those sorts of things. And we actually have talked about community bonds in the past, but not in a while. And there's been a ton going on, including some recent campaigns, some community bond campaigns in Canada. So we are going to return to that topic, talk some examples, talk about how the market has evolved. Tim Nash is our guest. He is a sustainable economist and the founder of Good Investing. Hello, Tim.
Bruce, such a pleasure to be back.
I'd love it. Do you have like a competitor called Bad Investing?
I've thought about that on April Fool's Day.
Back. Yeah.
What people often tell me is like good investing. Well, what if someone comes around and does great investing?
Yeah.
You know, you'll be in trouble then.
You totally will. Yeah, you totally will. A community bond is what?
Yeah, it's a regular bond. So, you know, when you think of a bond, we're loaning money. Usually it's to governments or corporations, right? And we're loaning the money, we're buying a bond, we're getting a certain interest rate every single year. And there's a duration for the bond. And at the end of that duration, 3 years, 5 years, whatever, you get your money back. So a community bond, first and foremost, is a bond. But what's different about it is that we're loaning money to nonprofits and co-ops within our community. That this really is about building that sort of social infrastructure that we so desperately need right now.
And what's the process? Now, I hope it has evolved since the time, because I actually invested in one of these bonds probably after we spoke. This is a couple of years ago. And the process was pretty simple. It was online. It was pretty simple. But take us through it. How does it work?
Yeah. So, you know, really what investors want to do is, number one, kind of consider the sort of risks and opportunities. Of course, you know, disclaimer, all investments, you want to kind of take a good look at it, make sure it's right for you. From there, if you decide you want to invest, you are basically cutting a check to the nonprofit or co-op. Now, we live in the day of digital transfers, so, you know, there are ways of doing it digitally, but really we are investing directly with the nonprofit and co-op. You're probably going to want to read their offering statement first, just to, you know, wrap your head around it, make sure it's right for you. From there, you're going to invest your money. For most clients, I suggest we do it outside of a registered account. So they're kind of
outside of our house.
No,
like we have to do it outside under a maple tree. No, outside of the retirement account. How come?
Yeah, well, just because it's a bit of a pain. I mean, these things, they're just not really recognized by a lot of the banks, the online brokers. Legally, you can hold them inside of an RSP or TFSA, but it's a bit of a pain. There's extra paperwork. Sometimes there's an annual fee. So for most of my clients, especially if you're doing the minimum, usually it's sort of $1,000 or, you know, $5,000, that, you know, really you just want to do it, you know, just regularly. You're going to invest directly with them. You're going to get your interest payments sent directly into your bank account. You know, usually it's twice a year. So every 6 months, you get a little cash in there. You get your T5 slip at tax time. And then at the end of the term, you know, usually a little bit before the bond comes due, you'll get an email from them saying, hey, do you want your money back or do you want to reinvest it?
I'm going to focus on the pure investing part. And then we'll come back to the social impact part. But how do the rates of return, how do the interest rates that these bonds pay compared to what a client might be able to get otherwise through a municipal bond or a corporate bond or a bond ETF?
Yep. So, you know, rates are going to be about the same. Again, it depends on the offering. So, you know, anywhere from about 2% to about 5% is what I'm seeing in the market right now, which is absolutely comparable to a GIC or to a government bond. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, you are taking more risk here, right? If we think of a GIC as absolutely zero risk, completely guaranteed, you know, government bond is going to be AAA rated, you know, very, very safe. Here, we are loaning to a nonprofit or a co-op. So they are going to be considered riskier by traditional means. So it's not really that you're getting a lower return on your investment. It's more that you are comfortable taking that extra risk, knowing that this is a smaller organization than, you know, what would typically be offering a bond.
What problem do these community bonds attempt to solve?
Oh boy, it's that age-old question. How are we going to pay for it? That name the crisis. We can talk about the affordable housing crisis that we're in right now. We can talk about the climate crisis that we're in right now. We can talk about youth experiencing homelessness, right? And all of these huge, major societal crises that we're facing right now. You know, the question is always, we have all the solutions, but it's how are we going to pay for it? And so what community bonds do is they allow an additional means of fundraising for a nonprofit. Now, this isn't, you know, charitable giving. Obviously, it's a bond. So they have to be, you know, earning money through government grants. Maybe they're a social enterprise and are selling a product, you know, but really, and it's usually to buy an asset. So this is usually a nonprofit or a co-op that's, for example, buying their building. So that instead of paying rent every single month, they're able to buy their building, ensure that they're going to be there providing their services for decades to come. And then when the bonds are paid off, you know, in however long it takes, you know, 10 years, 20 years, until that asset is completely owned by the nonprofit or co-op, then their finances are in great shape because they own their building. They're not paying rent anymore. They're not even paying a mortgage anymore because they own that building. So, you know, lots of great examples. You know, the ones that are really coming on board right now are geared at affordable housing. So there's a great co-op out in Kelowna, BC, that is, it's Kamloops, BC, that is a sustainable housing cooperative called Propolis. And what they're doing is building this really cool building, you know, this whole sort of bunch of different units, a project that is going to be cooperative housing. But how the heck do you build a co-op? You know, where do they get the money? Well, in this case, a big chunk of that is coming from community bonds, letting people in their community invest in this co-op to build more sustainable, affordable housing.
You referenced risk, and I think it's important for us to include that, though I don't know what percentage of someone's decision would be about the financials versus the interest in making a difference. What happens if that development goes wildly over budget, if it's underutilized, if they lose their government contract, if they're sued, et cetera, et cetera? And is there any data on how often these community bond offerings implode, where people don't actually get their money back?
Right. So to be clear, you know, with a bond, the first thing we want to make sure is that it's an asset-backed bond. Those are my favorite. If you're funding an organization's operation, that gets a little, you know, dodgy in my books. That, you know, I really like the ones that are asset-backed, because in the event of a default, right, which can happen with any bond, right? Companies go bankrupt, they default on their bonds. That does happen. If a nonprofit were to default for whatever reason, the first thing they would need to do is sell that asset. Right. And that asset's going to be worth something. Now, I can't tell you how much it's worth. You know, obviously, it's going to be dependent on not only the project, but also the timing of when that sale happens. But fingers crossed is that they are able to sell that asset for a good price, and they are able to pay off all of their debt holders, such that, you know, as an investor, as a bondholder, I get all of my money back. Now, that doesn't happen all the time. So if they're not able to get the full value of that asset, that's when bondholders are essentially in line. That when it comes to these different debt instruments, and usually, I'll be honest, the community bondholders are behind the banks and the mortgages, right? There are usually a few people ahead of us. And so it really depends on, you know, how much the organization borrowed and how much they're able to get from that asset. And the worst case scenario is that the investor does, we call it, take a haircut, but it's unlikely that they would get $0 back and lose all of their money. It could happen, but unlikely that in most cases, you know, the bondholder would sort of take a haircut on that investment and only get part of it back. But it really is going to depend on every single project.
Yes, and not a fashionable haircut at that. So as I mentioned off the top, we've been following these for a bunch of years. In particular, we were looking at ones on this show anyway, in the world of the environment, like solar power, stuff like that. Yeah. When you look ahead 5 to 10 years, what do you see? And hopefully you see more awareness of these bonds. What else?
Yeah, I think just the whole ecosystem is growing. Right. So it's been incredible looking at the last 5 years. And if you ask me to look at the next 5 years, oh my goodness, Bruce, I see so much opportunity here, because I really think we've tapped into something really special with this model. But to me, there's going to be more supply, so more community bonds on offer. Right. There's going to be more demand, that it's going to be a regular thing for people to allocate part of their investment portfolio towards community bonds. And then my dream is that we start to get even easier ways to buy them, and maybe in a way that's a bit more diversified. Right. Like, I would love, there's this concept of fund of funds that's very common in the investment industry. I would love to see a co-op of co-ops. Right? Or a bond of bonds, that where it's just like I can buy one product, and inside of that, I'm getting exposure to a whole bunch of different community bonds. You know, that would be my absolute dream.
Well, I'll just tap my magic wand and make that dream happen for you. You're welcome in advance.
Thank you.
One last question before we go here, and it comes back to this consumer awareness or trust or belief dynamic. So if everyone knew, we still couldn't assume everybody would partake. What is the single most critical question that you find yourself answering over and over and over again that people have on the credibility or the confidence in this type of a vehicle?
Yeah, really, I think people want to understand the risks, right? And that's really, you know, at the end of the day, what is that worst case scenario, right? And I always am very clear with clients about the liquidity risk. These things are locked in. You can't sell them if you need the money at the drop of a hat. There's the duration risk or the interest rate risk, that it's kind of like a fixed rate. So if interest rates go up or down, you know, it might not be as attractive as it was when you initially bought it. And then there is that default risk. Right. But really, what I want to communicate with the default risk, that yes, there is the chance that they could go under. But when it comes to the private market, like, you know, a lot of these companies that I see, they will close projects or go bankrupt, you know, very, very quickly. If a project becomes uneconomic, they will cut and run and leave investors in the dust. But when it comes to nonprofits, they don't do that. They are going to fight tooth and nail to make their bond payments, to avoid default, to keep their programming going, to have that positive impact that they have, that there is this real, you know, that in fact, their purpose, in my mind, almost makes them a slightly safer investment, because I know they're going to fight so gosh darn hard to keep the lights on and to keep those bond payments rolling.
Tim, I appreciate you joining us today.
It's always a pleasure. I'm a huge fan of the show.
Thank you. I appreciate you joining us. And mostly, I appreciate your passion for this. There are few people who walk through this earth with the exuberance that I hope I possess, and I would put you on that list.
Well, I'm happy to be in such good company.
It must be our shared London, Ontario connection. That must be it. Tim Nash, sustainable economist, the founder of Good Investing, and he was here to talk about bond, not James, community, bond. Coming up next on Moolala, what do you do if you cannot pay off your debt? Adam Fisher is a partner at insolvency firm Harris & Partners, and he's going to be here to talk about the options, in particular, one called the consumer proposal. Later, we're going to speak with personal finance columnist Leslie Ann Scorgi about retirement planning when you're self-employed. I mean, you want to get to the same end point, but how you do that in terms of creating a nest egg for yourself can be quite different. If you have missed an episode of Moolala, you can head on over to moolala.ca. In the top right, there is a pull-down menu. Pick podcasts, and that will take you to the page that will allow you to search either by full episode, you can listen to the whole thing, or also just by segment. So there's a little search bar. You can type in, I don't know, kids and money or real estate or investing, and it'll recommend segments. You can do the same if you have a guest name that you are like, wait a second, has Bruce talked to her? So check out our archive of more than 200 episodes, which is probably like, geez, 900 guests or something like that.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolala, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. There is always a way to get out of debt. Always, always, always. And for people who are in this circumstance, it certainly doesn't feel like that, but there are various options. They have pros, they have cons, but it's so important for everyone to understand that there are ways out. Some of them are really not fun. They have consequences, but there are ways out. So, you know, it can be budgeting. It can be debt consolidation loans. It can be refinancing your home. It could be a debt consolidation plan with a nonprofit credit counselor. And it could be something through a licensed insolvency trustee. And we're going to talk about those two options today. Adam Fisher is a partner at Harris & Partners, which is an insolvency firm. And he's joining us now to talk about the process and how to think through which avenue might be the best for you. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
We hear this term insolvency. We hear the insolvency statistics and licensed insolvency trustee. What does that word mean?
At its basic core, insolvency means you're unable to pay your debts as it becomes due, as they become due. And that can mean very many different things. It could mean that your liabilities are much more than your assets. It also could mean that you're unable to service even the minimum payments on your debt over time. And there's lots of other warning signs, for instance, that you might be insolvent.
People are dealing with a lot of stress these days. Rising inflation is tough. Rising interest rates is tough. Talk a bit more about when people should pick up the phone and call a firm such as yours in order to find out more about these options. What are the indicators that it's like, yeah, you just need to call them?
Well, I think one of the major indicators is that the mountain of debt that you have is so large that it's going to take forever to pay it off. Other things, you may be looking for other loans, you can't get them, you're having trouble making your minimum payments, you're running a deficit in your monthly income and expense, and the debt is increasing month to month and not decreasing. All of these things can be potential signs that you need to talk to someone. And to be honest, whether it's a great company like Credit Canada or a licensed insolvency trustee, the first call is always gratuitous, and it doesn't hurt to call and find out what your possibilities are.
Yeah. We're going to talk about the two services that the licensed insolvency trustees can work with clients on, the first being consumer proposal, the second being bankruptcy, which people talk about a lot more, even though these days consumer proposals are much more common. What the data is, something like 70% or so of filings are consumer proposals. Why is that?
It's really interesting because it's been a complete flip over 20 years. I was looking at the statistics and as of 2022, 76% of the insolvencies filed were consumer proposals. 10 years ago, it was only 39%.
Wow.
And if I was to venture to guess 20 years ago, it would be under 20%. I think there's various reasons that that's happening. So one of the reasons why you would file a consumer proposal is to protect assets. A lot of Canadians have houses across the country, maybe not in the GTA, with a little bit of equity and run into debt issues. And in order to protect their home ownership, they could do a proposal. Other reasons are income driven. A bankruptcy could cost exactly the same as a proposal similar to a proposal, but the proposal allows you to pay over a longer period of time. Mm-hmm. I think there's also a pretty strong view amongst Canadians that they prefer to do a consumer proposal to have everyone get a fair shake in terms of returns and to avoid the stigma of bankruptcy, because the stigma of bankruptcy remains a pretty significant
item. Describe the consumer proposal process. So, and we'll talk about criteria in a second, but if someone, this is a fit for someone, you've done the analysis, how does it work?
So the process in the consumer proposal is that, of course, you would go through an interview with hopefully a licensed insolvency trustee or someone that has knowledge on insolvency. And you've made the decision to do the consumer proposal. On day one, we would file the proposal, and then there would be a stay of proceedings. A stay of proceedings is a legal term that means a freeze on all credit or collection actions. It goes from everything from court to them not being allowed to take you into court to they're not allowed technically to do phone calls, creditor phone calls. Although, of course, they do. And then what would happen is as the administrator of the proposal, we would send out information to all the creditors about the proposal, and the creditors would have an opportunity to vote. They have 45 days to vote. We need more than 50% to vote in favor. And then there's basically a 15-day appeal period for court approval of the proposal. If no creditors appeal what's gone on, then you get court approval. And then it becomes a matter of making payments. Most consumer proposals are 60 months in length. And once you make those 60 payments that the creditors have agreed to, the debts are extinguished, and the implications of the credit remain, but you don't have to worry about the debts anymore. And in between day one and the end of your payments, the debts are sort of held by the stay of proceedings. I would say, call it in purgatory, or they're frozen.
Right. Purgatory. Ugh, I don't like that word. Let me ask you this. What guides the range of the cents on the dollar that a client is required to pay as a part of those proposals? Because it's not the same every time. For some clients, it's 20 cents on the dollar. For other clients, it's more. How does that get determined?
So there's numerous factors on how it comes determined. And initially, the trustee needs to be looking at what the floor of the payments are. And the floor of the payments to determine the floor, you have to determine what the creditors would get in a bankruptcy. And there's two places where the creditors would get a return in bankruptcy. The first place is from any assets you have, most commonly amongst Canadians, that would be interest in a house. It could be investments as well. At least they're non-exempt assets. RRSPs, for instance, are an exempt asset. They wouldn't count in that calculation. So the trustee would do a calculation of what your assets are and also what you would pay in a bankruptcy. You pay in a bankruptcy based on your income. The government provides a calculation. They call it a surplus income payment. I like to call it a bankruptcy payment because that's what it is. And because with things so tough, most Canadians say that they don't have any surplus income. And basically we do that the calculation of what you would pay in the bankruptcy, add the assets, that's the floor. And then we have to look at, you know, what the creditors are willing to accept. And it depends on who the creditors are. You know, like a rule of thumb is that roughly a third of the debts is a good amount that the creditors are often willing to accept.
Over that 60 months, they pay that monthly payment, they keep paying it, and the debt portion is complete, but there's a hangover here in terms of the implication for the credit score. How significant is a hit? And how do you address that for clients who wants to have a hit to their credit score? No one does. And that's just a part of how this thing unfolds.
So the consumer proposal and bankruptcy as well. And for that, for probably all of the processes that allow you to get rid of debt, it's a trade-off. The trade-off is how badly you need the relief versus how bad it's going to impact your credit. And basically in a consumer proposal, your credit goes to an R7. It goes to an R7 for the lesser of 6 years from the date you file a proposal or 3 years after the date the proposal is completed. And that is compared to an R9 in bankruptcy, which is in a first-time bankruptcy 6 years after you complete the bankruptcy. The issue is that most Canadians are much more in tune with what the credit score is than what the credit rating is.
Right.
And because it's a secret formula, I can only give you what I believe is, you know, a rough measure of what a consumer proposal does. So when you file a consumer proposal, depending on how strong your score is to begin with, and the stronger it is, the more it's going to fall. Mm-hmm. You're going to lose probably 100 to 200 points.
Right.
After the first distribution is made by the trustee pays the creditors every 12 months until that fifth year is completed, and then they made all the payments. Each time the trustee makes the distribution, in the right circumstances, the credit score should start to go up slightly. So I think it takes between 12 and 24 months for the credit score to bottom out, and then it goes up very slowly after that. Obviously, there's a lot of factors, and I'm talking on experience because, mm-hmm. as we know, those sort of things aren't known. And I also wonder if that's your experience, Bruce.
Yeah, it is consistent. It is consistent. One last question before we go here. Credit Canada is a nonprofit credit counselor. Licensed insolvency trustees are for profit. How do you frame for clients how you make your money? Do you talk about it like an estate lawyer who charges you a fee for a will, or an accountant who files your taxes? Like, what's the dollar amount that people should have in their mind, and what should they understand about how you make your money?
We're regulated by the federal government, and our fee in a consumer proposal is based on a tariff that the government assigns to the proposal. Maybe one of the reasons for the proliferation of proposals is that the government had seemed to want to push people more towards proposals than bankruptcies. And ultimately, one of the ways they've done that is to probably have a better compensation in proposals than bankruptcies. So what happens is the the debtor, or the person going through the consumer proposal, would pay an amount into the proposal, and the trustee would have an entitlement from that amount, nothing on top of that, but an entitlement from that amount for the fees. The entitlement is $1,500 plus 20%. So different trustees say different things. I like to believe that, you know what, if there's a fee within the $200 a month or $500 a month that you're paying, you are paying the fee. Some of the trustees frame it as the creditors paying the fee, but the creditors are aware of what the fees are, and they're looking at what the bottom line is to them.
Right. Really interesting stuff. Adam, thank you for your context. I think you and I are both big, big, big believers in people finding out more before they feel like they have no other options so that they can make an informed choice and develop a plan. So I really appreciate you taking the time today.
Okay. Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it as well.
Adam Fisher is a partner at Harris and Partners, an insolvency firm. He was here to talk about the basic insolvency options, consumer proposals, and bankruptcies. But as he said, most of the clients coming to LITs in this country are moving towards a consumer proposal these days.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Coming up later, self-employed personal finance columnist Leslie Ann Scorgi shares her tips for retirement planning when you own your own business. But first, we'll speak with tax lawyer Amit Umat about how to file a tax dispute with the CRA. Could take you years. And to stay up to date with all things Moolala, very simple to do so, we have a newsletter. The newsletter comes out once a month, and it brings together various stories and interviews that we have done at CityLine and BNN Bloomberg and CBC Radio and all that stuff. To sign up for that newsletter, you go to moolala.ca. And do not worry, we will never do anything with your email address other than send you that email with the newsletter about once a month.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Preparing your taxes is stressful as it is, at least for me it is. But what if, you know, you file that return and the CRA comes back at you with something and you don't agree with the take that they have on your particular circumstances? There is the option of filing a dispute, but I certainly wouldn't know where to start. So we're going to look at that process and how it unfolds, when to determine if it's worth your time and energy to pursue. Our guest is Amit Umat. He is a tax lawyer, and he joins us from Burlington, Ontario today. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. How are you?
What are some examples of maybe more common disputes that people have with the CRA over and above, I don't want to, I don't like that number, like something that would actually count as a dispute?
Well, that's a really good question, Bruce. There's a lot of issues that people encounter, especially in the tax context. I think some of the more salient ones include the CRA assessing unreported income to a taxpayer, or one that is very prominent at the moment currently is our real estate assessments. Our real estate assessments relating to people selling homes too frequently, or building brand new homes and selling them too quickly.
We'll talk about those both specifically, but what is the very first thing that people should have in their mind before they even begin to consider whether they should pursue this? It seems like it could take time and money and patience.
Well, all of those. But Bruce, that's an interesting question. And it harkens back to a Latin maxim, si vis pacem parabellum, which loosely translated means, if you want peace, prepare for war. So my advice is always to prepare for a dispute prior to it occurring.
Wow, I love that phrase. It kind of makes me moderately terrified, which I think is a great phrase. So the two underreported income, rather, and real estate assessments. Let's start with the underreported income. So what would the CRA come back and say? You had income that you didn't report here. You need to add it on to your, you know, to that particular line.
Yeah, so very generally, what will happen is someone will report very low income on their tax return generally, and the CRA will red flag that return and say, well, how is this individual living off of $15,000 of income per year? Then they'll look at your books and records, and basically a net worth audit will be conducted, which will mean that the CRA will determine what your assets are, they'll determine what your liabilities are, subtract your liabilities from your assets, determine your net worth, add in your personal expenditures, the amount that you spend on a yearly basis, and then tell you what your income actually is versus what you reported.
Wow. And then what? So once they tell you what your income is, then I assume they tax that at the marginal rate.
Precisely. They tax that, but not only that, they also penalize the taxpayer pursuant to the gross negligence penalties on the basis that, look, you knew that you earned much more income than you reported. So we're going to penalize you on the basis that you're grossly negligent. And those penalties can be 50% of the tax owing.
What would be the defense for the taxpayer who is reporting 15 grand a year, but lives in a beautiful home, takes international trips or whatever? And when a third party looks at that math, the CRA does, they'd say, yeah, kind of makes sense. You're living a baller lifestyle here.
Yeah, no, well, it happens, right? I mean, I know of many circumstances where individuals report low income, but live a lavish lifestyle. And it's possible to do that. But generally, what you do is you hire your professionals, you hire your CPA and your accountant and your lawyer to go through the books and records to determine where they went wrong. And the CRA itself and the tax court itself has called the net worth audit a blunt instrument. And so it is routinely incorrect. And it's incumbent upon the financial professionals of that taxpayer to determine where the mistakes have occurred.
Tell us about the process. So this is what you do. It begins with probably a panicked or infuriated call from a potential client.
Certainly. So it'll start with a brown letter indicating that, look, we've chosen you to for an audit. And so there's three stages of a dispute. And that's the first one is the audit. The second one is escalating it to the appeals division if you take issue with the audit's reassessment. And the third is tax court, which is the final destination. That's litigation. But yes, it will start with a letter indicating that the CRA intends to audit. And then what usually happens is I'm called at that point by the accountant, indicating that this is out of their wheelhouse and we need a professional to get involved at this point.
Every single case you touch, I am sure, has similarities. And every single case you touch, I'm sure, is completely different. What is the gestation of a dispute like this? How long does it last typically, knowing that there probably is no typically?
That's a really good question. And of course, you're going to hate when I say this, but it depends, Bruce.
Yeah.
So if it's a smaller amount that's been reassessed, I mean, I have files, you know, with between $1,000 and $500,000, you can usually wrap that audit up in within a year. We've had files with over $25 million of unreported income, and those files are still moving their way through the process. And that the audit can take 2 to 3 years alone. But if you want to talk, generally speaking, from start to finish, from audit to appeals to the tax court, it can take 5 to 7 years.
Wow.
Yes.
You really have to sign up for that. I mean, I'm sure there's a financial case to be made when the stakes are high, but boy, 5 to 7 years, I couldn't hold a grudge for that long if I tried.
The CRA certainly can.
They certainly can, I guess. Why don't work for the CRA? What is, again, and I know you're going to say it depends, but just can you give me a sense for the percentage of cases, ballpark, that would go from audit to tax court? If you're audited, is it 1% who might pursue it all the way to tax court, or is it 50%?
I think generally speaking, if we take audit being 100%, at least, I think maybe 30 to 40% could potentially be resolved at the appeals division, which is when you file the notice of objection. And then for the ones that are remaining, I'd say at least half make it to tax court. So if we're looking at the ones that begin at audit, probably 10 to 20% minimum make it to tax court.
Anytime I have hired a lawyer and they have done great work, but boy, is it expensive. Do you work on hours or do you work on contingency? How should people think of the dollars associated with pursuing a dispute like this? And yeah, I know it depends.
It depends particularly on the client and the client's preferences. So I will charge an hourly rate because it's easier to control. However, I will offer flat fees if the client would prefer that. But look, I'll be honest with you, Bruce, when you quote a flat fee number, the client usually doesn't like it and would prefer the hourly rate because generally they don't want to pay any more than they have to, which is something I fully understand.
Yeah. They also may be a deluded optimist like me and think, guys, it's only going to be resolved in like 2 weeks. This is going to be easy. And then you realize, as seasoned as you are, you're thinking, not the case. How would you advise people on the cost benefit thinking that they need to do? Obviously, there's a financial component. So there's your fees. There's probably other professionals who need to put time in, but also the psychological cost of what your word could be a war with the CRA that could unfold over the course of years.
So financially, it's very rarely does not make sense to hire professionals to fight a tax dispute because of the amounts involved. And certainly people are usually upset in situations where they've been penalized. So that's never really been an issue because the amounts are rather large that the CRA has assessed in this particular office. Psychologically though, Bruce, this is where we come in, right? So we act as a shield for our clients. We take on the brunt of that. We ensure that clients are not affected psychologically by these matters to the extent possible.
We talked first about the underreported income. The second area you flagged was real estate assessments. Are they simpler to resolve? Can we go back to empirical data in an easier way?
Well, they're easier to resolve in the sense that ultimately you win the real estate cases by telling a compelling story. I mean, it all hinges on a carefully crafted narrative. And so that's much different than an unreported income case where let's go through the numbers.
What would be an example of a great narrative on real estate assessment?
You'd have to have a really good story. So I have clients that, I'll give you one. So I have this woman who has moved from, she moved from 3 or 4 houses. She started at one house, moved to another. All of them were brand new builds. So the houses were demolished, rebuilt. But she had very little to do with it. And her husband was the one that was behind it. And ultimately, she was basically taken for a ride. But the CRA says, look, you're on the hook for 50% of the HST on the sale of these homes on the basis that you're the title holder to these homes. And so we're challenging them. And the assessment's over $1 million. And so we're challenging that on the basis that, look, you have the wrong person. This is not the individual that should be liable for the HST. So that's one example of someone that quite clearly will be able to establish that they're not liable to the tax.
Is that couple still together?
No, they're not. No,
okay.
They're not.
I can see then it being really in her vested interest to fight that. There are some people who can afford a lawyer who are, the stakes are sufficient that would make sense to hire a lawyer. There are other people who can't afford counsel and the stakes aren't as high. What other resources are there for those folks?
I think you should always, any individual who believes that they have a reasonably good chance of succeeding in tax court should still make the calls because there are tax lawyers out there that will accept a file if it's reasonably winnable and for the right client. And that myself included. I mean, you shouldn't be precluded from having your day in court on the basis that you're maybe not able to afford a lawyer.
Very interesting stuff. Thank you very much for your perspective. I both learned something and also feel grateful that I have not been in these circumstances because I think that would be not the funnest thing ever in the history of the world.
Well, thanks for having me on, Bruce.
Amit Umat is a tax lawyer. He joined us from Burlington, Ontario, and he was here to talk a bit about the process that you're signing on for if you decide to dispute findings from the Canada Revenue Agency. Stay with us. Coming up, personal finance columnist Leslie Ann Scorgi will be here. She's going to talk about retirement planning for those who are self-employed. And you can be pretty sure that self-employed folks do not have a gold-plated pension. They will need to save on the side. I'm also the money columnist for CBC Radio. So just a note, Wednesday afternoons, we talk about finance topics in the news, relevant to you, relevant to your financial life. And we do that on all of the drive home shows on Wednesday afternoons on CBC. So perhaps we can meet there too.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Being self-employed can come with a lot of benefits. You get to be entrepreneurial, you get to be your own boss, maybe you get to set your own hours, you know, most likely 10, 12, 14 a day sometimes, but there's lots of flexibility. On the other hand, running your own business, being self-employed, will almost certainly not include a traditional pension plan. You are going to be responsible for saving for your retirement. Leslie Ann Scorgi is a personal finance columnist for the Toronto Star. She is the founder of the financial education company MeVest. And in one of her recent columns, she talked about starting the retirement planning process for folks who are self-employed. And we decided it'd be a really helpful conversation for us to have on this show. She's in Toronto with more. Hello, Leslie Ann.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
I love that you're focusing on this demographic, because I think it really is a group that is underserved. The traditional financial services companies, the products, everything's very focused on people with a job. Why did you decide to write about self-employed folks?
So during the pandemic, the freelancer pool grew by 70%.
Wow.
And we saw so many people launch and start businesses. But the real reason I wrote the article about like what to do with your retirement planning if you're an entrepreneur is because I see two very big mistakes entrepreneurs are making. And it's like, they're very costly. And so like the first one that I talk about is the fact that a lot of entrepreneurs assume that retirement savings are kind of like magically going to appear down the road when the cash flow of their business is much stronger than it is today. And then the second mistake is that the business itself, and like hopefully selling it eventually, is the retirement nest egg, and that the proceeds from the sale will be enough to cover like the full cost of their golden years. So you know this, like, because I'm always hopeful. I am an entrepreneur,
yes.
But I can tell you that these two things, even though they might happen, in many cases, they actually do not happen. Mm. Or if they happen, it's at like a much reduced amount where it's just not enough, or it is actually too late. And so with the way time marches on, as it does, the more entrepreneurs put this proactive retirement planning business off to the side, because you just called it out, like they're working 14 hours a day, the more they put this off, the less benefit they have from compounded interest, reinvested returns, and like almost more importantly, the retirement savings habits that are necessary to like really grow and like grow your nest egg and be ready for retirement.
The first one, the magically appear in the future, it's almost consistent. It is consistent with the diluted optimism it takes to be an entrepreneur, right?
I was just gonna figure it out.
The second one, though, I don't know what the stats would be, but the sale of your business is, especially when it is a founder-driven business or a professional service, it's really low.
It is very difficult. And like, I've got a number of students who have tried this avenue. And interestingly, one of my students who's been with me for a very long time, her father just went through this process. He's 70 years old, like banking on a sale of his consulting business. And of course, nobody buys it because he is the business is himself. Mm-hmm. And so he went down his retirement planning path thinking that somebody would just pay him like $2.5 million for this book of clients. And the unfortunate reality is that if you are in especially a service-based business where you are the face of it, the chances of raising the proceeds required for a retirement are quite low. And that is not a retirement plan.
There is the cash flow component. And we can come back to that in a second, because often, especially when you're starting a business, it's so hard to have money to save, let alone continue to invest in the business. But before we get to that, I want to ask you about the savings vehicle, because right now there is a tax-free savings account, there is an RRSP. For entrepreneurs who are incorporated, they can also have a non-registered corporate investment account and keep all that money in the business and invest in a diversified portfolio in exactly the same way as if it were outside of the business. What are some of the pros and cons to option number three, an account that is the corporate investment account?
Yeah, there are some key benefits there. We'll step this one back to not get it super complicated, but keeping money within the business and investing it corporately obviously prevents it from flowing to you personally until you need it. That means that less income tax is paid on your personal income taxes. So there can be benefits there. What I find very interesting is that I'm seeing more small businesses look at other techniques to set up almost like pension plans within their business or for their small business, like individual pension plans and deferred profit sharing plans. And all of this, like if it's held within the business, some of the benefits are that the administrative costs and the contributions themselves can be deductible against the earnings of the business. Mm. So that's yet another avenue, but I think it's all to do with taxes. And for entrepreneurs, yes, you've got the TFSA, yes, you've got the RSP, but let's not forget that growing your nest egg within your business is a totally viable option. And it can have that flexibility to craft a really well-balanced portfolio within the business. Like I said, kind of like preventing any unnecessary taxes. Mm.
Yeah, because if you keep the retained earnings in the corporation, then you can just keep yourself on salary or dividends up until
Correct.
The day you die, provided there's
Correct.
A nest egg
yeah.
there and that there is a huge tax advantage. A lot of self-employed folks and entrepreneurs, they don't choose to incorporate. They're going to have a GST number if they're in excess of 30 grand or so. How do you steer them to TFSA versus RRSP?
Oh, it's like one of the most asked questions I get. Like, and the answer I say to most entrepreneurs is like, there is a 95% chance that both of these tools, the RRSP and the TFSA, are actually going to play a role in your retirement planning. And the degree of that role is what should be very carefully planned year by year with two really important people on your financial dream team. The first person is your financial planner. That second person is your accountant. So there are reasons why you might prioritize the RRSP over the TFSA. So like, let's say the pool of money you had to invest was $1,000. If you check in with your accountant, check in with your financial planner, and they say, you know what, you make a certain amount of money, it's going to make sense for you to put more money in the RRSP this year, they'll split that available amount of money in a proportion that's going to be most tax advantaged. So it could be that 2/3 of that money might go toward the RRSP and 1/3 toward the TFSA. But here's what I'm getting at, is that these two tools should play a role. And they're going to change year over year. The prioritization of how much goes into each of those tools is going to shift a little bit. And it has everything to do with how much you're paying yourself personally from your business. So there is no, like, unlike, you know, when you're a T-Ford employee, we usually say save 10% and that's fine, you know, and it's split, like, depending on the income level, maybe it's mostly RSPs and you just max out your annual contributions and your TFSA. So for small business owners, it will be an evolution is what I'm getting at. And it should be an evolution because the way you pay yourself is likely going to change. If you've been a business owner for any length of time, more than like 3 years, you know that cash flow changes, what you pay yourself changes. And there may be years in which you do different techniques for paying yourself to be more efficient. And that will change which of those tools you're going to use. So incorporated or not, it has a lot to do with how much you are personally paying. And again, that's that blend of advice that you want from your financial planner and your accountant coming together. Like, you know, it's so funny. I see a lot of business owners like separate their financial planner from their accountant. And like, I think bring them together. That's like one of the best money moves. If you're a business owner, like bring these two people together so that they can work on your file, like with the lens of making you more wealthy. That's the goal.
That is the goal. Okay, we've just got 1 minute left. One of the things you believe is most critical for entrepreneurs, for self-made millionaires, is consistency.
Absolutely.
Why is the C word so important? Consistency word.
You know, as an entrepreneur, cash flow goes up, it goes down, it goes all around. So what I can tell you is research shows that consistently making contributions, consistently meeting with your financial advisor to change and tweak your strategy, consistently evaluating how all the techniques and strategies to grow your nest egg, consistency and making it a priority to ensure you are funded properly for your golden years is what will make all the difference. The good news is that entrepreneurs are by default consistently persistent. And so we know you have it in you. And it's very much about whether cash flow is good or bad, that you're making contributions in the most efficient way possible to your retirement nest egg. And that is by design with your planner and accountant.
Leslie Ann, so helpful. Thank you for making the time for us today.
Thank you.
Leslie Ann Scorgi, a personal finance columnist with the Toronto Star, founder of the financial education company, MeVest. And she was joining us here today to talk about retirement planning, not just financial planning, but retirement planning for those who are self-employed. That is our show for today. Thanks to our sponsors, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. To reach us, very simple to do so. We are available on email. I know, does that sound 2004? It sort of is. I mean, I am on social. I will tell you how to reach me on social, but email is easiest. ask@moolala.ca. You can also subscribe to our newsletter, as I mentioned earlier in the show. That's at moolala.ca. And subscribe to the podcast version of this SiriusXM show. It is available on any of the platforms you visit. While you're there, leave us a review. On Twitter, @BruceSellery, SELLERY, Bruce Sellery Moolala on Facebook. Thank you so much for listening and have a great day.